Hello and welcome to Behind the News. Two guests up today, both Behind the News veterans. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Cynthia Enloe, a professor at Clark University, who is a peerless expert on militarization with an emphasis on gender. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Richard Seymour, keeper of the Lenin's Tomb blog and author of a new book, The Meaning of David Cameron, and he'll talk about the new government in Britain. First, just a few words in the news, since today's interviews are rather long, and besides, I'm on something of a little vacation. You might be able to hear the bird song in the background, and so not paying all that much attention to the outside world. So just about the U.S. economy, and then a bit about U.S. politics. The burstlet of growth that the U.S. economy saw in late 2009 and early 2010 now seems to be fading. The Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago publishes a National Activity Index, a composite of over 80 indicators that provides a neat summary of the state of the national economy in a single statistic. After recovering nicely through March, it slid in its last two readings. And the portents for the future aren't so good either. The Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which is designed to forecast moves in the broad economy 3 to 6 months out, hit a recent peak in April and has been in a downtrend since. It's forecasting, if not a second leg of recession, at least a slowdown later this year. The last thing we need right now is to go crazy cutting the deficit. Let's hope the American political system is too paralyzed to do something that stupid. Speaking of the American political system, it was exhausting to slog through all this orchestrated public mourning for West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd, the man who loved the Senate. A Google search in the words Robert Byrd loves Senate yields almost 250,000 hits. Okay, I'll concede that he outgrew his youthful membership in the Ku Klux Klan, but loving the Senate? Some things are unforgivable. The Senate is an awful body, a pit of high-stakes gasbaggery, consciously designed by the architects of our government as a check on popular opinion. I'm not making this up. Here's how the Senate's official history on its own website puts it. To the framers themselves, Madison explained that the Senate would be a necessary fence against the fickleness and passion that tended to influence the attitudes of the general public and members of the House of Representatives. George Washington is said to have told Jefferson that the framers had created the Senate to cool House legislation just as a saucer was used to cool hot tea. That's the end of the quote from the Senate website. That's really something to love, isn't it? But Byrd sure knew how to shake down the legislative machinery to get projects built in his home state. Yes, West Virginia is one of our poorest, but wouldn't it be nice if we had explicit economic development strategies that were openly discussed and recognized as just and useful, instead of pretending we're just a bunch of self-reliant cowboys who hate the government? Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about sex and war. That was a bit of the Gang of Four's I Love a Man in Uniform. My first guest is Cynthia Enloe, whose specialty is gender and the militarization of society. Enloe is a professor in the Department of International Development at Clark University in Massachusetts and is director of the university's Women's Studies program. She is author of many books, most recently The Curious Feminist, and before that, Maneuvers, The International Politics of Militarizing Women's Lives, and Bananas, Beaches, and Bases, Making Feminist Sense of International Politics. When the General McChrystal affair broke last week, my first thought was to give Enloe a call. Who else could make sense of McChrystal's unwillingness to go out to dinner with some French diplomats because that would be so gay? Cynthia Enloe.
In a sane world, you'd be getting a lot of calls in the McChrystal affair. Is the world sane? Are you getting such calls?
Well, I don't think I'm the test for sanity, but no, not really. I think that Doris Kearns Goodwin, I think people who are really historians of or intimate followers of the American presidency are the ones who first come to mind, or people who are military historians per se. I think people who, like a number of us, are more generally trying to follow militarization, trying to chart its ups and downs, mainly ups, in American public culture and private culture, I don't think we're the ones who come to mind, except to your mind.
Well, I was struck in that Rolling Stone piece, among other things, by the mockery of the French and McChrystal's reluctance to go to dinner. And I think one of his aides says, it's all so gay. Decode all that for us, please.
Well, I think for a long time in American culture, and not just since the whole French fry debate, or it shouldn't even be a debate, but silliness, I think the French have stood for many Americans, and particularly Americans, both men and women, who are concerned about American masculinity. I think the French have stood for a more effeminate form of masculinized culture. I don't think they think that that women run France. I think that these people who are anxiety-ridden about their own masculinity or about their own country's masculinized status see the French as run by men who are not in the frontier John Wayne, maybe McChrystal mode, and it becomes kind of an easy target or an easy reference point. I mean, in fact, of course, the French have been highly militarized, and until recent political reforms, which are really quite dramatic in terms of party nominations and electoral rules, but until that, in fact, women were quite underrepresented in French public life. That's now really turned around, and it's quite dramatic. But so France is not a less masculinized political culture, at least not till recently.
Well, I think, though, isn't the problem with the French political culture, French culture in general, that the men are pansies, not that the women are prominent or not?
That's right. And I don't think they really think that the French political elite are gay, as in the sense of homosexual. They're just not properly Americanized in their masculinities. And because in recent years, particularly since 9/11, and the French government's, and I think quite wise, reluctance to join in the rush towards a militarized response to 9/11, ever since then, there has been this sense that the French can't be trusted because they rely so much on diplomacy. And in this country, and this is very worrisome, in this country, I think, particularly since 9/11, but I think it was starting before that, diplomacy as an activity, as a political activity, as a political skill, has been feminized. And in this culture, and in many other cultures, probably most, anything that becomes feminized risks losing its status as serious.
When we last did this during the heat of the Bush years, you mentioned that the State Department has long been feminized. It's interesting that McChrystal's crowd made an exception for Hillary Clinton. So you have a tough woman running the State Department is almost getting masculinized. What's up with that?
Well, and I think she's been very deliberate about that. I mean, I think in this culture, and particularly in the State Department, from the very start when she accepted Obama's invitation to become Secretary of State, she immediately looked at what had happened to Albright and particularly what had happened to Colin Powell. She really had paid very close attention. Of course, she was in Congress, she was in the Senate, and she was on the Armed Services Committee very deliberately, one of the first New York senators to pursue a position on the Armed Services Committee. She knew exactly what kind of politics she was dealing with in this country. And I think she saw, particularly under Colin Powell, she saw the State Department being constantly marginalized during the Bush years, and marginalized not just in terms of structure, but in terms of this culture of kind of who can out-macho the next around the national security table. And so she, when she accepted the position, I think from the very start, from what I don't know her personally, but I think from the very start, from what I can understand, she was determined that under her watch, the State Department would not be so marginalized. And I think one of the things that that has meant is that she has really tried to ensure that she was seen as the equal of Robert Gates in the cabinet, that is the Secretary of Defense. And I think she also is inclined towards more militarized solutions, but she, as Secretary of State, is determined that the Defense Department not run diplomacy, which the Defense Department increasingly has over the last 10 years.
It's interesting that, you know, you mentioned Colin Powell. Of course, he was a military man, emphasis on both those words. How did he get, and the department he run, get feminized under those circumstances?
Well, I think from what, I understand, he was one of those generals which come up in 20th and 21st century American politics who spent a lot of his time in Washington and learned how to be effective in the American civilian-run political system. And he learned a lot of political skills and I think a lot of respect for civilian political ways of doing things. And as a result, he really came into the State Department with not just a military man's mindset, but also with a respect for civilian diplomacy. And under Rumsfeld, having this close relationship with Bush and with, more importantly, with Cheney, they managed to paint this military man, this career military man, Colin Powell, they managed to paint him as somehow less militarized and therefore less trustworthy, in their terms, than they, who had done almost no military service between them, Rumsfeld and Cheney, not to mention Bush.
So this is all, a lot of this is just symbolic strutting.
Yes, but symbolic strutting has its purposes when you are running a very intimate senior-level national security team. So it's not everything. Structure matters, budgets matter, the history of your organization matters, and your capacities as an organization. They all matter. One shouldn't reduce everything to simply personalized culture. The culture matters, and it's wielded. It's wielded just like budgets are wielded.
Powell is also a reminder, though, that the military, in many ways, is a bureaucracy, an organization that, you know, depends on procedure and hierarchy and tradition. It's not necessarily a place where strutting individuals can survive.
Thinking about the U.S. military and most militaries these days as bureaucracies, I think, is really valuable. In fact, the men and now a few women who have risen in the U.S. military career service, that is, as uniformed officers, have been highly skilled or become highly skilled or learned to be skilled in bureaucratic politics. And that doesn't just mean Machiavellian sort. I mean, it really means that they know how complex organizations work. They know who you should CC on a memo. They know what are the processes and how, if you have a strong view on U.S. military operations someplace, that you it's not just your view that counts. It's who do you get on your side within the bureaucracy? Who do you make sure you're in the room with? And, you know, all of us who have been in academia in the very much smaller ponds of bureaucracy know that that matters. And it's not necessarily devious. Any of us that work in large organizations know that it really does matter who is CC'd on a memo. It does matter who's invited to what meetings and who is on what email lists. Those things do matter, and they have to matter if you're working in a complex organization. And American military generals that have, or men who and women who have risen to the ranks of admiral or general, and there are now several women admirals, they've had to learn that the U.S. military is not just tanks and guns and missiles and doctrines. It is running and being able to be effective within a complex organization.
So let's get to the McChrystal issue. What do you make of the fact that he was performing this tough guy routine, and his comrades were performing this tough guy routine on the record for a reporter? It was nothing, you know, no subterfuge about it. This was all pretty much out in the open. What do you think he's trying to do with this?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I think partly Michael Hastings, who was the reporter for Rolling Stone, who, if you will, got himself embedded with the McChrystal and his senior aides and was with them in Paris, and then their plane got delayed because of volcanic ash, and then he went with them to Berlin, and then so it took a long road trip back to Kabul. And I think that there's a kind of boyo, we're all blokes together, kind of spirit that grows up amongst them. I mean, I wonder what it would have been like if just half of them had been women. Now, if it only one had been a woman, let's say that, you know, a senior aide, and my understanding is they were all men, but let's say that one of the senior aides was a woman, it would have been very hard for her to change that tight, masculinized dynamic of boys on the road. And I know that sounds very trivializing, but, you know, it does begin to have that kind of spirit sometimes. And you add that to the clear frustration that McChrystal and some of his other senior aides have had because their own strategy has not gone well. Their first big test of their strategy with the Afghan surge was in the town and region of Marja, and it's not been a success. They drove out the Taliban, but no government, Afghan government services have been effectively following in their wake. The Taliban is moving back into Marja. So their first attempt to put their own security military new strategy into operation has not worked. So they were frustrated, and then they had this very blokey kind of tight atmosphere as they slowly moved from Paris to Berlin to Kabul. And my guess is that it did matter that Michael Hastings wasn't reporting for Glamour. He wasn't even reporting for, say, Newsweek. He was reporting, and they all knew it, and Michael Hastings' editor has even opined the same, that it does matter that it was Rolling Stone. You know, that you want to kind of look good in Rolling Stone. I'm not sure. This is the kind of thing only a really good ethnographer would know. And maybe Michael Hastings is reflective enough that he really can think about this and tell us more. If you're the reporter, if that kind of dynamic starts to take over, you stay really quiet. You try to become invisible because you think, uh-oh, they're becoming more indiscreet because they both know who I am. They kind of like the Rolling Stone identification. They're frustrated. They're now spending a lot of time together as guys. I'm just not going to remind them that actually I'm taking notes or I've got the tape recorder going. So there was probably a dynamic that began to take over there. But it does matter, I think, that it was an all-male small group. They haven't been named, but I wondered whether they've been reprimanded at all.
I'm speaking with Cynthia Enloe, a professor at Clark University. It's good you mentioned the fact that the war is not going well. I mean, it lost in the story of the personalities, which is very interesting and understandable. It grips a lot of people. But this war is a disaster. And whether you're going to blame the military for it or bite me and Holbrooke for it, it's still, we're forgetting that. Now, McChrystal's being replaced with Petraeus, who is the senior architect of this strategy. So is anybody thinking about that?
Well, actually, and just to remind ourselves about Joseph Biden, he is within the White House inner circle. He is the most opposed to the U.S. being more deeply militarily involved in Afghanistan. He opposed the surge when Obama was working out what became his West Point speech, spelling out his new policy. So he's one of the ones who, in fact, he's very skeptical of this deeper military and political involvement in Afghanistan by the United States. But I think Obama I was quite aghast when he made that decision back in the winter to become more deeply involved. I can understand it. I can understand the pressures that he was under, and my guess is I think Clinton was also in favor of what has become now the surge. My guess is that back in the winter, the senior policymakers surrounding Obama who were in favor of this deeper involvement were most scared not of Afghanistan but of Pakistan, and that their worries about neighboring Pakistan really might have, as I say, I don't have inside knowledge here, but that would be my guess, that that was really the worry, and I think it was Clinton's worry as well. But I think it's, you know, I think it's a big mistake, and I really feel badly for Obama. Kind of reminds me of Lyndon Johnson. You know, his strength is domestic politics, and here he's got himself so immersed now in Afghanistan, and there's still the oil spill off of the Gulf Coast, and that should be his priority, and he's being really pulled away from it. So I think it's a, I think it's a mistake on several levels.
This sort of takes us back to where we started, because there are certainly many military, political, strategic reasons why the U.S. is involved in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But there's also the issue where Obama has to prove his manliness. So let's talk a little bit about how he is portrayed. He's he's slender, which I think figures into how people appreciate him. He is of mixed race and a rather cerebral. So
tell us about the masculinity of...
Yeah, but athletic. And, you know, here we had Bush, who was a draft dodger and a cheerleader in college, is nonetheless
portrayed as untroubled
with
masculinity.
A very big belt buckle.
Right. And Obama, his masculinity is always in question, isn't it?
Yes, just like Clinton's. I mean, I think that, and this is something about, really, we need to be really much more serious about this. It's one thing to be kind of jokey, and I certainly am guilty of that, about the ways in which masculinities and rankings of masculinities are so dominant in American political life, public life. But it's actually quite serious because it leads us to make wrong assessments. It leads us to misplace our trust or to create distrust where it doesn't belong. And I think it is true that presidents of this country who are civilians, most of whom now will have had and do have very minimal military service, and they're very conscious of that, it makes it so imperative for them, because of us, we are the problem. I actually don't think the senior military is the main problem. They're trying to figure out which president or presidential candidate they should trust, but I think it's us as the general public who have to really get our heads around what kind of persona, what kind of character attributes we think are most useful and valuable and trustworthy in a chief executive of a very complicated political system at this point in our country's history. And too often, the shortcut of cartooned version masculinity takes the place of that kind of thinking. And it means that candidates, and Obama and Clinton and both the Bushes, they're good politicians. They read us. They watch us. They listen to us. They try to get a sense of what we worry about and what we trust and what we fear and what we joke about, what we ridicule. And so they come into office, those that win, determined that they will meet our, I think, warped, I'm talking about the general inclinations of us as a public, to meet our warped expectations of what an American president should be. And nowadays, it's you must prove that, first of all, you can act like a commander-in-chief. And that is not the first job of an American president. It is on the job list. But the more that we allow the U.S. military, and again, it's us, the civilians, who are doing it, to become such a predominant institution in American public life, not just in Washington life, but in public life. We think it's good that junior ROTCs are in public schools, for instance. We fly fighter bombers over football games to open the season. You know, we are the problem. And so long as we send that message to political candidates, they will come in thinking they've got to prove that although they never did military service, they are reliably militarized.
This we, though, I mean, we're talking about electorate that's slightly more than half female. Not all the men are warmongers. So is it the most backward segment of society that sets the tone somehow?
Oftentimes. And I think the rest of us don't necessarily, we haven't really crafted a way to take issue with it. We do sometimes joke about it, but I don't think we necessarily have really come to grips with the ways in which warped notions of masculinity feed jokes about France or feed jokes about, you know, who is more macho than whom in around the cabinet table, whether Hillary Clinton, you know, wears the pants, which of course she does, but I mean in the symbolic sense. All those sorts of things are kind of inadequate when it comes to really taking issue with this quite popular version of what we should expect from senior civilian officials in public life. So we're not very skilled yet.
So to bring this to a conclusion, when we're talking about the civilian control of the military controls the psyche of a lot of those civilians, doesn't it?
Well, I think the thing is, yes, the military does in a way, but I don't think it's the military controlling us. I think it's us. And I am using, you know, we're not a monolithic us, and certainly most of my pals, and I should say also students who I talk to around the country, they don't necessarily buy into this. But there is a respect for the man in uniform. And there is, the thought now that at high school graduations, civilian, public, high school graduations, there is special mention at the commencement ceremony of those graduating seniors that have already enlisted and are about to go into the military. Well, the military hasn't forced the commencement choreographers of a public school in Illinois or Massachusetts or Arizona to do that. It's us.
That was Cynthia Enloe. Enloe teaches in the International Development Department at Clark University, directs the Women's Studies program at that university, and is a prolific writer and frequent speaker on the topics of gender and militarization. Back to talk British politics after the break.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say...
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. If you do visit our website, don't neglect to hit that donate button. We can always use the help. That was a bit of Beethoven's Variations on Rule Britannia, not one of his more distinguished compositions, performed by Alfred Brendel. My next guest is Richard Seymour. Richard is the keeper of the Lenin's Tomb blog and author of The Meaning of David Cameron, just out from Zero Books. Zero isn't widely distributed in the U.S., but the book is available from Amazon and other online sources. A couple of words of background on the British election. The election was held on May 6th and yielded an inconclusive result. The Labour Party had run Britain since 1997. For the first 10 years of its reign, the Prime Minister was Tony Blair, an enthusiastic supporter of George Bush's foreign policy, including the invasion of Iraq and the attempted occupation of Afghanistan, and he was an enthusiastic neoliberal in the economic realm. He was succeeded by Gordon Brown in 2007, just as the bubble economy was about to burst. The war and the bust left Labour very unpopular. In the election last May, the principal opposition party, the Conservatives, or Tories, didn't win an outright majority in Parliament, and so was forced to enter a coalition government with a perpetual also-ran of British politics, the Liberal Democrats. The Tories, the party of Margaret Thatcher, had purportedly reinvented themselves to be shiny, modern, gentle, and even populist. But their leader, David Cameron, comes out of an aristocratic lineage with deep ties to British finance, and he spent 7 years as a public relations professional. The upper-class City of London PR background is all relevant to what follows. Richard Seymour.
I don't think Americans have paid a whole lot of attention to the British election, so let's see if we can do a little bit to correct that. Cameron, David Cameron, is now in a what looks like a weak coalition government with the Liberal Democrats. Is his government going to be able to do much of anything, or are they just too hampered by the weakness of the election results to get their way?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that there has been a bit of a lash-up, organised principally by the civil service, the elite in the civil service, who, spotting that there would be a potential for a hung parliament and a weak government, a minority government, moved very quickly to organise a week-long period of negotiations between the parties that would result in a settlement that all the party leaderships could agree to, and that was what resulted in the Clegg and Cameron agreement. Previously, both party leaders had been rather hostile to the idea of being in coalition with one another. So, I mean, this is something that has enabled them to temporarily gain enough seats in Parliament, enough votes in Parliament, and enough public support to start the process of savagely cutting expenditure. And that's the big thing at the moment. It's really crisis management. And I expect that any government that we had at the moment would be doing much the same thing, though at a different pace and on a different scale.
Yeah, I want to get back to that in a little bit. But first of all, the presentation of the new Tories, very much in the model of New Labour, I guess a reinvention of an old party, has been they're compassionate. They're not bigots. They're modern. They're decent. They're even concerned about inequality. What is behind this self-presentation?
Well, I think there are a number of things. I mean, first of all, there is a sort of grammar of progress which has been made intelligible by New Labour and obviously by deeper long-term structural changes in British society and in the norms of political discourse. To flesh this out, I think what's happened is that an older idea of progress in which it means something like the movement toward greater equality, toward more liberty, and toward a society less characterized by extreme forms of inequality and domination has been replaced by an older idea of progress which is rooted in classical liberalism, the liberalism of I guess it really goes back to Hobbes, but and you can find it in conservative ideologues like Burke, but then in later on in Hayek. And that's an idea of progress that is measured by accumulations of goods, wealth, and technology. And so we have a discourse in the UK where progress is almost co-substantial with globalization, with more and more international trade, with the intermingling of cultures that goes along with that, and with the celerity of capitalist culture. Now that's, I mean, there are aspects of that that are indeed advantageous. I mean, setting aside, you know, everything that's wrong with it. But that isn't really to do with progress. Progress, as historically understood and the term is used on both sides of the Atlantic, I think, really has to do with domination and freedom and those sorts of questions. So also in regard to the question of the Tories' attitude to inequality, it's quite clear from Cameron's policy announcements and from his various discussions on this subject that he takes his discourse on inequality from New Labour. And what he favours in response to inequality is not greater equality as such, but inequality of a different kind. He favours what is usually called meritocracy. And that is essentially the idea that the distribution of rewards in the society will be allocated to those who have exercised their talents to the best effect. And that's an idea that has historically been used to justify class inequalities rather than to attack them. And it's something that has comfortably coexisted under New Labour with a staggering rise in inequality. And it's also led to, I think, a sort of cultural effect, an obnoxious cultural counterpart, wherein the rich feel more and more entitled to their wealth and more smug about it, and end up, as we've seen in before this election, some of them calling for a return of poor law-style reforms, you know, where if people are unemployed, they have to accept whatever job that they're offered, otherwise they'll end up living in enforced accommodation, living on subsistence rations. You know, this is the sort of 19th century thinking that is going on alongside the appeal to meritocracy.
Many years ago, I met at a conference Sir Alan Walters, who is one of Thatcher's top advisors, and he said that one of Thatcher's lasting achievements, perhaps her most lasting achievement, was the transformation of the Labour Party. First of all, what do you think of that? And second of all, what now is left of Labour after Blair and Brown?
Well, first of all, I think it's absolutely true that Thatcher changed the Labour Party, or at least introduced real substantive changes in British society, that such that the Labour Party had to change, and not for psychological reasons, not because it couldn't win enough votes if it stuck to a social democratic programme, but more for reasons that a government that tried to implement social democratic reforms on an old Keynesian-style platform would very quickly find itself edged out of power, you know, with attacks on the currency and with the loss of confidence among business and the right-wing press and so on. So I think she set about making changes in that respect, and she also changed the nature of electoral coalitions by the changes that she introduced in British society. As for what's left of the Labour Party, I think there was an element of New Labour that really wanted to absolutely destroy the old class-based nature of the Labour Party as being, you know, rooted in the trade union movement, rooted in organised labour. And they introduced various reforms within the party that reduced the trade union's influences in it. However, that has not been entirely successful. And noticeably, in the most recent election, the Labour Party experienced a real surge in their working class base, quite surprisingly in many respects, given that the working class has been the main constituency that has abandoned New Labour over the last decade. And in addition to that, the major funding for the Labour Party in 2010 came from the trade union movement. Big business funding was reduced to a minimum, in contrast to previous elections. And, I mean, even at the highest periods of Blairism, you had to have serious negotiations between the Labour Party and the trade union bureaucracy over policy. And that would usually come up in the 6 months prior to an election, and they would thrash out an agreement, such as the work agreement, which would protect certain minimal standards for the working class, for public sector workers, for the labour movement, and so on. And then, of course, once they got elected again, they would usually, the Labour Party in office, would usually turn around and tear that up. But the point is that they still have a relationship of dependency with the trade union movement, and most of the leadership contenders, in fact, all of the leadership contenders at the moment, including the most ultra-Blairites, such as Andy Burnham, the Milibands, Ed Balls, and so on, are talking up their need to reconnect with the trade union base and with core working-class voters. That awareness of dependency is pushing them to deal with this issue, although the temptation on the right wing of the Labour Party leadership will be to try and resolve this in a very reactionary way by through socially authoritarian measures, through attacks on immigrants in defence of the so-called white working class. So there's still something of Labourism left. I don't think it's being completely demolished. It's the nature of capitalism that's changing, and whether the change, the altered system that emerges after the prolonged crisis and the cuts process that's being pushed through now, whether that enables a renewed reformism, a renewed kind of social democracy, remains to be seen.
In a way similar to the way Thatcher transformed Labour, the Labour has also transformed the Tories in a certain sense. I mean, well, how does Cameron and his movement, or whatever that is he represents, how do they depend upon the transformations wrought by Blair?
Well, you see, I think that the transformations in the Tories, in the Tory party, are quite artificial and superficial compared with the transformations in the Labour Party. I mean, there is a tendency to speak of New Labour as if it's just an alien formation that just leached onto the Labour movement, a sort of parasitic entity that can be shaken off and then we'll go back to good old Labourism. I don't believe that's the case, but they did make fundamental changes in the nature of the Labour Party. They did win it over to the most aggressive forms of pro-market policies and neoliberal ideology. I think that what Cameron has done, consistent with his career choice, is to effect a PR change. He's recognised that there are certain policies and legacies that are deeply unpopular with the British public, and he's pragmatic enough to distance himself from Thatcher. However, if you actually read about his political thought, his own inspirations and so on, he's a fairly conventional Thatcherite in his outlook, and he's got a lot of admiration for Thatcher and what she accomplished, and that's his background. And the people he surrounded himself with are a mixture of, people throwback to the Thatcher era, and neoconservatives, people who are informed, their policies are informed primarily by their dedication to the Atlantic Alliance, to an aggressive foreign policy led by the United States. Incidentally, that latter part ties in with the Tory conception of progress in a way, because under New Labour we've had another aspect of progressive ideology, so-called, being promulgated, which was the idea that the Western world, as it were, led by the United States and the NATO alliance, was the major force of progress against various forms of, you know, reactionary nationalism, religious chauvinism, and so on. And that therefore a sort of globalizing capitalism with enlightened Western states at its head was the major world historical force of progress, and that it should be championed by left liberals on that basis. As it happened, that did win over a sizable sort of left liberal constituency, especially with respect to the war on Kosovo, or rather the war on behalf of Kosovo as it was sold at the time. But that fractured over Iraq, and what's interesting about this is that Tony Blair and New Labour were driven more and more into the arms of the European right in order to sustain their policy, and into the arms of the Conservative Party, whose votes they frequently relied upon to pass their legislative measures. So the Conservative Party inherits that, doesn't fundamentally alter that orientation. In fact, is quite explicit in that it's pursuing what William Hague and David Cameron, William Hague's the Foreign Secretary, William Hague and David Cameron call liberal interventionism, which is just a straightforward Blairite foreign policy adapted to, 2010.
I'm speaking with Richard Seymour, who is the author of The Meaning of David Cameron. Under the that PR surface that you're talking about, and these guys, I'm impressed by how young they all look. Some of them look barely old enough to vote, and yet they're running a country. What is the social base of the Tory party, and has that really changed much over time?
It hasn't really. And, to be honest, all parties, opposition parties, when they're a little bit energetic and when they're on the way to power, they tend to look a bit younger than they do when they've had 5 years in office. The speed with which Tony Blair aged is a case in point. But their social base, I think, is still overwhelmingly older white males. Actually, to be fair, traditionally in the UK, women have tended to vote Conservative more than they have voted Labour. But that has been changing. Certainly it changed in 1997. So there's no longer a case that women necessarily vote Conservative more than men do. As regards social class, we're talking about key bases. I think the primary base of the Conservative Party is that class that is the owners of mass manufacture, of mass service provision, and of international finance. That's the kind of internationally oriented capitalist elite that is integrated into the Conservative Party leadership. And in fact, if you look at the Conservative Party's front bench, in opposition, the shadow cabinet consisted, I think, of about 19 millionaires out of a total of 29 members of the shadow cabinet, which is proportionately rather high. And most of them have made their money out of finance. Actually, if you look at George Osborne, the chancellor, he is a trust fund kid. His father became wealthy out of business, and invested in a trust fund for him, and obviously that has matured and grown in the financial system. And so, I mean, these people have a very natural class alliance with specifically the financial bourgeoisie, but with the capitalist class in general. As regards extending beyond that, there are two groups that they can mobilize. The main one is the petty bourgeoisie. I mean, historically, the petty bourgeoisie, the lower middle class, as it were, sole traders and shopkeepers and so on, have overwhelmingly voted for the Conservative Party. They were the bedrock of Thatcher's base. In the last election, there was also a movement towards the Conservative Party among the what's called the skilled working class, which implies that there is a section of the working class that doesn't have any skills, which is rather odd. But nonetheless, the skilled working class, as it were, well, it dissipated and dispersed in various directions, not just the Conservative Party, but the Conservatives were able to attract some section of, what you would call the C2 group of voters that are described as the skilled working class. So that, I think, is the Conservative Party base. It at the core is the high capitalist class, and around it is a periphery of lower middle class voters and some sections of the working class.
And there must have been a lot of disillusionment with the performance of Labour in office, especially in the last several years.
Yes. I mean, it's quite unbelievable because Gordon Brown took office, despite not having stood for election as Prime Minister, with a considerable amount of goodwill. I mean, the polls suddenly jumped. Labour had been losing. They were trailing in the polls quite badly under Blair. People despised Blair. I mean, it's really difficult to recall just how bad it was, but people really hated Blair. And suddenly you have Gordon Brown in, and you have an apparent change of personnel, and cabinet ministers are coming out openly, distancing themselves from the Blair era and saying that things will be done differently. But within a matter of months, particularly after Brown bottles out of an election contest, which he sort of floats in the papers he might be willing to call, the polls have absolutely collapsed. And then he introduces a number of measures that hurt his own base. So, for example, he withdraws the 10p tax rate for poorer taxpayers, which, I mean, he ends up having to take back. There's apart from the fact that the disillusionment, the old disillusionment on the political level returns, there's also a sense that Gordon Brown is utterly clueless and doesn't know what he's doing, and that there's a reason why he spent so many years in the wilderness not daring to challenge Blair and so on. It's because he's absolutely hopeless. There's considerable disillusionment, and I should stress that this disillusionment comes as much from the right as it does from the left. Maybe that sounds like it's a commonsensical observation, but if you look at the anti-war movement, for example, I think there was really two factions in that. I think it was ruled and led, if you like, by the left, who initiated it, who made up the bulk of its activists. But in terms of anti-war opinion and feeling, there's a large bulk of it, a large body of it, that is basically right-wing, and that would like to have the troops return, mainly because they don't think that we should be involved in helping other people out, which is what they assume we're doing. And I think that on a whole series of issues such as immigration, there's the government have actually, New Labour actually enhanced that trend among a section of the population to move further to the right. I guess what I'm saying is that there was a real level of polarisation against New Labour during their period in office. And in 2010, what happened, interestingly, was that some of the a very sizable portion of those who had really moved away from Labour to the left moved back to the Labour Party in recognition of the threat that the Conservative Party posed.
And now, of course, shiny new David Cameron in office has introduced a pretty old-fashioned austerity program. Tell us about that and how is it being received?
Right. Well, I think the first thing to note is that the Conservative Party have announced cuts. The major cuts they've introduced at the moment are cuts to welfare. And they are talking about coming back for more. But they've also pointed out that they will be expecting to cut 25% of all departmental budgets in non-ring-fenced areas of spending. Now, the ring-fenced areas include defence and international aid. International aid is a tiny part of the budget, so you could almost set that aside. Defence is obviously very important for the Conservative Party because they are committed to the ongoing war for Afghanistan. Health is another area that's supposedly been ring-fenced, but anybody who pays attention to what's going on at local authorities and trust levels is aware that all the trusts are already negotiating and preparing and planning for closures and spending cuts and so on. So I don't take that particularly seriously. Still, 25% cuts across all departmental budgets that are not ring-fenced is really quite substantial. And the Tories will be working very hard to shift the burden of opinion in favour of making more cuts to welfare than anything else, because that's the major goal, especially with respect to pensions. They're talking now about increasing the pension age eventually to the age of 70, which in a large part of the UK is well above average life expectancy. So basically meaning that many people will work, particularly the poorest will work till their dying day without ever seeing the pension that they've invested their tax and national insurance money in. As for how it's been received, the fact of the matter is that at the moment public opinion is prepared to give the Liberal Conservative coalition the benefit of the doubt. I don't believe there's real enthusiasm for these cuts. But I believe that the polls show that there is a general acceptance of the need to make cuts at the moment, and that when the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats came out pretending that these cuts were vaguely progressive, and that they were going to have a go at the bankers, they were going to have a bank tax, and that they were going to cut taxes a little bit for the poorest workers, this was received by some people, particularly some Liberal Democratic voters who would traditionally have been hostile perhaps to that sort of agenda, as some sort of signal of progressivism. Actually, studies introduced by the Institute of Fiscal Studies and reports by the Financial Times and basically various statements by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and others all suggest that the net impact of these budgetary changes will be to dramatically decrease the consumption of the poorest. The spending power of the lowest decile, the bottom decile, will be reduced by about 8%, whereas the spending power of the top decile will be reduced by a maximum of 2%. So it's a really regressive, really reactionary budget. It's one that's going to hit working people very hard. It's just that I don't think it's sunk in quite yet. The one group among whom it has sunk in very quickly is public sector workers. They are, of course, the core of the Labour Party vote at the moment, and they are going to be the core of any anti-cuts movement. That means that when strikes start to take place and when you start to see protests against these cuts, it is going to feed into dynamics within the Labour Party itself. In fact, I think you can already see that starting to happen.
Yeah, this leads me to the final question, which is we have this government, which looks like it has a weak electoral base, introducing potentially very unpopular cuts and potentially economically very damaging cuts. It's also tied to U.S. foreign policy, which means two awful wars. We also have a Labour Party, which is bereft of ideas and looks kind of lifeless, at least from this distance. What is your prognosis for Britain's political future?
Right. Well, I think that there is something in that analysis, but I don't think Labour is completely bereft of ideas. I think that all the credible leadership candidates are bereft of ideas, but I think that there are elements within the Labour Party who have a fairly traditional social democratic response. And there are some forces to the left of Labour, for example, in respect, which lost quite badly in the last election, but which would tend to gravitate toward Labourism anyway, who have that sort of, who uphold a sort of Keynesian redistributive kind of politics. So I think that if in the event that you start to see industrial action taking place among public sector workers, in the event that you start to see public sector unions pushing for resistance to these cuts, you will start to see elements within the Labour Party come to the fore insisting that this be made part of the Labour Party's purview. I'm not convinced that they're going to have much success with that because the hold of the right wing on the Labour Party bureaucracy is too great. And I think that in the long term, we will have to look to building some sort of coalition, a fairly broad one, that is to the left of the Labour Party and which doesn't make the same mistakes that were made by the Socialist Alliance and by Respect. In the immediate term, I think that we're going to have to wait and see what happens with the economy. Because if there really is a double-dip recession, as people think may happen as a result of this budget, because of the sudden contraction in demand that's likely to take place, the political legitimacy of this government will be shot to pieces. There are already signs of dissent within the government, you know, for example, by people like Simon Hughes and Charles Kennedy, who are fairly old-fashioned centre-left liberals in the Joe Grimmond mould. And they will be tempted, I think, if things get too bad to maybe defect or at least to try and cause some sort of split. There's all sorts of things that could happen, but I think we're going to have to wait and see what happens with respect to the economy and whether or not public sector workers have the confidence really to initiate strike action against this government.
That was Richard Seymour, keeper of the Lenin's Tomb blog and author of The Meaning of David Cameron, just out from Zero Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this choice bit of Nick Lowe's I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass, which has no political relevance, unless maybe you're a black blocker up in Toronto the other week. Till next week, bye.
I love the sound of breaking glass.